Welcome to the Profitable Farmer Podcast, where we share stories and tips to help you run a better farming business and create your very own freedom farm. If you're looking to work smarter and not harder in your farm business, welcome. You're in the right place. G'day, and I hope this finds you incredibly well. In this podcast, it gives me great pleasure to interview Jim Gore, now CEO to RB Sellers. As you will well know, RB Sellers is a pretty incredible brand and equally an incredible story. Now an iconic regional Australia and rural Australian brand. I look forward to sharing part of their story with you. But just as much, I'm really excited to reconnect with Jim Gall, who is an old school friend of mine and a great friend to my brothers. As much about learning his philosophy and approach to leadership, Jim has grown up on a farming family near Euroa, and over his business career as an entrepreneur, has started Red Handed Creative, which he built and sold to Clemenger Group, a global marketing and advertising agency, and then went on to be the CEO of Clemenger Australia New Zealand for some time before retiring from that position and now arriving into the CEO role at RB Sellers. So he's got a really compelling leadership story. He sat on lots of other boards and held down a lot of other corporate executive roles. So there's so much that we can learn from Jim just about his style of management, his style of leadership, and how we can apply that to how we turn up to manage our families and our teams on farm. So sit back, enjoy this. Jim, great to connect with you. Congratulations for your recent appointment with RB Sellers. And as always, thank you for sharing your story.
Jim, thanks so much for your time. Great to see you. How are you?
I'm well.
Jim, have always known you to be an entrepreneur, and I'm sure it started before you kicked off Red Handed. Where do you reflect that your interest in business and entrepreneurship started?
I think on the farm, Jeremy. You know, growing up with Dad doing lots of different or running different enterprises. You know, with sheep and cattle and loose and hay, and then at different times we had some cash enterprises like chickens and garlic and a few different things. Dad tried quite a few different things. By the way, he's 86 and still farming, so he must be doing something right. But I think, you know, we were making a lot of different things, and certainly the foundation of entrepreneurship, as far as I'm concerned, is if you make it, you've got to sell it. And I think that's where it all really started for me.
You mentioned if you make it, you need to sell it. How good do you think farmers and small business owners as a rule are at marketing, Jim?
I think they're getting a lot better, you know, and I think the great thing about marketing is there's no better person than the person growing it or producing it to tell an authentic story to a consumer. And we see a lot of marketing these days telling stories that aren't true, or, you know, they're a derivative of the truth. And I think people now, when they look at brands and they're looking to buy a product, they want to align their values with that product. They want to understand where it came from and how it was grown. And I think, you know, farmers are in a very strong position to tell a really powerful, authentic story about what they're growing. So it may not have been, you know, markets might have been a little tough in the past in terms of, you know, the supply chain. But I think today we've got a lot more access to consumers through the digital economy where we can actually sell from paddock to plate.
Is that absolutely no doubt? I think you and Suze do it at the moment, Jim. We'll get into your more corporate career and your successes shortly, but you do paddock to plate from your farm at Euroa into Melbourne and surrounding regions. Would you mind speaking to that?
Yeah, sure, Jeremy. It's a cottage industry, Jeremy. I wouldn't say we're doing anything at any large scale, but we produce prime lambs, which we sell or send to an abattoir not far down the road in Wangaratta. We have a few different butchers that we work with in Wangaratta, Benalla and Mansfield. And then we sell to those markets, and we also transport that product direct to consumer in Melbourne. So that brand's called Faithfuls Creek Lamb. And so it was an exercise in test and learn for a start, that maybe we could try this and see how it goes. We've got a good little customer base. We'd love to grow it more, but I'm a little bit occupied at the moment, unfortunately.
Absolutely. So, Jim, what are your tips to farmers on how they can better tell their story?
I think you probably hit the nail on the head there. Tell your story. You have to have something that is distinctive, first and foremost, so people can recognize it. You must have a story that's differentiated, so it's different from your competitors. And then it needs to be a story and a product that is valued by a consumer. Distinctive, differentiated, and a value are really my three themes in terms of telling a story that's going to resonate with a consumer and hopefully be commercial.
So what were those three again? Distinctive?
Yeah, distinctive. So to stand out, to really make sure you look different to others, to be differentiated in terms of your product or supply chain, or how you may present your brand differently to a competitor, and then obviously a product that has a value attached to it that a consumer values. So whether it's the taste, or whether it's the packaging, or whether it's the environmental credential, or whether indeed it's the price, they're all differentiating factors that can drive those three components.
Thanks, Jim. Hey, congratulations on your recent appointment as CEO to RB Sellers. An incredible achievement. What's your read on that business, and how have your first few months arriving there been?
Firstly, thank you for the generous commentary. I haven't achieved anything yet, so let's not get into any achievements. So I certainly was drawn to this business because of its, its customer base. And, rural Australia really is what I'm all about. I believe that, the regions have an extraordinary opportunity and role to play in the national economy and, in fact, in the global economy. So a clothing brand that people wear every day that keeps them, protects them from the sun, that they can depend on, that looks good and says to them, you're serious about what you do, from my perspective, is a really exciting bunch of traits that make the brand incredibly valuable. So, I think it's something I was drawn to. As soon as the opportunity came up, I grabbed it, and I'm really looking forward to growing the brand and the business over the ensuing years.
So, Jim, how do you describe that business? What does it practically look like, and what impresses you most about it?
That's a really good question. I think there are a number of factors to it. I think it's designed here and made to last, which I love. It's not made here. We'd love to make it here, and that's something that we'll be working on. But we certainly make it to a quality and to a fit and to a standard, with a really good price point that really serves a need in the market. And, I think our connection to country is also incredibly important, so that we're true to our brand and true to that customer in everything we do. So I think we've got a business that's sort of a good business today. We've got 150 or so staff. We've got 22 stores across Australia and New Zealand. We've got our own DC and warehousing and distribution, so we control pretty much everything from when it lands to when it's in our customers' hands. We've got a strong e-commerce business, all the elements of a foundation for a business are there. But, we certainly see it being a big opportunity to grow in terms of the product that we offer, the customers, the wider customers that we we service, and also the accessibility of the product, so making it available in more places.
What's the backstory to RB Sellers, Jim? You know, it's a competitive space. You know, there has been Thomas Cook, Garin Williams, and lots of others playing in the rural apparel market. Yet RB Sellers, certainly in recent years, has become just an absolutely iconic Australian brand. And I can only imagine the market share that the business now commands. And for me, the loyalty of the customer that you have managed to accumulate over time. How's that achieved?
Oh, back to the original story, I think, you know, it was founded by an individual who loved rural Australia, was very connected with his customers and spent time on the road meeting his customers, understanding what his market wanted. Richard Sellers Jones, the founder, was a Thomas Cook salesperson, if we remember that brand. It's still around, you know, boots and moleskins and shirts, man from Snowy River stuff. Richard got a really good understanding of that customer base whilst he was out there. He then grabbed that opportunity to develop his own business and slightly nuanced the product, understood what the fit was that Australian farmers wanted, the durability of the product, and I think even most, well, more importantly, the price point, really understood where the value in the market was. So Richard was always of the view that we make a good product that fits well, that's accessible to everyone. Who works the land, and I think that's where that product fit is and remains. You know, we obviously there's a few more products than the original work shirt. In fact, that work shirt story is a bit of a iconic story in our business. Richard, when he started the business, had a mate who went jackarooing, a real adventurer, who unfortunately passed away in his first couple of years since leaving school, and his name was Harry Burton, and the Burton work shirt was named after him. And it's a great story, I think, a great honour, really, for Richard to honour him and his adventurous spirit in rural Australia. And now more than, you know, well, across Australia, we sell, I think, more than 200,000 work shirts a year of Burton work shirts. And so Harry Burton's name's everywhere, and I think that legacy still continues today. We've got a product that is made really well. In fact, I think it's a better shirt now. It certainly fits you better. You know, a lot of it has Australian cotton in it, and it's an exciting product. Although it's a work product, you can wear it into the pub. You can wear it, you know, to school. You can dress your kids up in it. You can dress your wife up in it, and it always looks good and performs well. So, yeah, I think we've got a great customer, we've got a great product, and I think we've got a great story.
How does a business like RB Sellers align its team and do things like strategic planning? Just out of interest, sort of, would you mind sharing some of the inner workings of a business like that, and how you're coming to know how it does what it does, Jim?
Yeah, I think all businesses are different in how they undertake the strategic planning process, and it depends on the governance of that business as well. We have a board, so, you know, made up of our shareholders, and, you know, they've got a very good and clear understanding of who our customer is, what it is that the business does, and how we will continue to grow. And then that directive comes down, you know, really at an executive level, which, you know, then we develop a strategy with our executive team, which meets the requirements of our board and is governed by our board. But we obviously overlay that with, you know, operational innovation, product innovation, customer understanding, you know, retail excellence, and, you know, really from a customer perspective, depth of understanding of all of the segments and how we can extract as much value as possible for our customers and also the business. So it really is a strategy set by the board, strategy executed by the executive, and then obviously culture and team and operations run right through the business.
How does a business like RB Sellers do culture, Jim, and how do you impact that across so many outlets?
Culture. Wow. I mean, there's that great saying of, culture and strategy for breakfast. And I must admit, I'm a bit of an advocate of that proposition. But, it's interesting working in the corporate world for a number of years. There's a lot of interesting things that go on culturally. And, we all know the stabbing in the back and the sort of evasive behaviours that exist. But I think, where I came from, and I think in the opener we talked about that, people tend to look you in the eye and punch you in the face in the country. There's a lot more honesty about feedback. And it's not as abrasive as that in terms of the culture we run at RB Sellers, but it is a direct feedback culture. And I'm a big advocate of radical candor as a methodology in really leading and challenging our teams with that mindset and with that mentality. And I think radical candor is an interesting one, because on the face of it, the view would be it's just about really direct feedback. It's actually a lot more than that. It's about building that psychological safety with staff and with your direct reports, in order for them to accept direct feedback, and then also give feedback and feedback that you're comfortable with, that you can deal with and you can grow. So I often ask our people to be really radically candid with me, and I appreciate it when they do, because I think when it's going both ways, you achieve growth very quickly. So business is about momentum. And if people aren't being honest and open and transparent with each other about how we can be better and how we can understand our customer better, then I don't think you can move that quickly. If you're open and honest about it and that candor exists, I think you can be. So that's certainly a methodology that that I think really propels businesses.
Radical candor. So, Jim, do you feel like there's a place for that, and how would a farming family apply that in a small business and a family business team?
Yeah, it's interesting across generations and within families, because, you often try and avoid conflict. I think that's when I first sort of started to read about this, and Kim Scott, if anyone knows Kim and follows her, there's some really good pointers on how to have those conversations with your peers or direct reports or your bosses or your dad or your children. But it's a really important process because it removes the emotional, from the argument. If you're comfortable receiving feedback from the old man about how to do something better and give him the opportunity to, then he mightn't be so critical if you stuff it up. There is opportunities both ways to really grow, I think, when you have this sort of methodology. I think, some other strategies that I've seen that really work in rural areas is, and on farms is, it's reminding yourself often it's not mean, it's just being clear. I think little techniques like praising, those that you're working with in public, and keeping your criticism private. I think being specific with your feedback is critically important, and not personalising it. And I think fundamentally that growth comes from demonstrating confidence in people, focusing on the strengths and not always the weaknesses. So you both feel like you're growing. And I think I don't care where you live or what business you're operating, and I think particularly in rural areas, you've got to be honest, you've got to be transparent, and you've got to be able to accept feedback as well as give it.
Jim, does it start, this comment that you make on radical candor, with being able to receive it? Is that where it starts?
Yeah, I think, we all know lots of people who are happy to give it. I think it does start there. I think it starts with feeling confident that the feedback you're receiving is coming from the right place. place of trust, and we're not trying to do the wrong thing. We're not trying to embarrass you. We're not trying to do anything other than make you better. And I think within yourself, as soon as you, you know that that's the sentiment and the intent, then it doesn't matter what you say to someone. It really is about taking it on and making change and making improvement if you agree with it, and making improvement and growing from there.
Jim, you've been CEO of multiple companies and on many boards and directorships. How do you describe your leadership and management style?
I think I'm direct. I think I'm purposeful, and I think I'm inclusive. And I often talk about success, and Jeremy alluded at the start of your intro about my background in sport. I didn't really do a lot after school, but I love sport and I was not bad at it. And what I loved about sport, I love about country sporting clubs as well, is that it, you know, the success is shared success, and the feeling of winning is pretty shallow if you're winning alone. And I think when you're building a team culture where shared success is prioritized over individual culture or individual success, I should say, it's incredibly powerful. So yeah, I think shared success is ultimately my ambition when I enter any company, because it makes me feel great. It's not always about the money. It's not always about the most innovative product, but it's certainly about both your customers and your team and, you know, your fellow leaders experiencing success together.
Jim, speaking to my brother, who's a good friend of yours, when I asked him to sort of describe you in preparation for this, just said that you have this unique ability to turn around businesses that might have drifted away from their core foundations, their vision, their product, their service, or their customer. We'll talk about Red Handed and some of your prior projects shortly, but would you mind just speaking to that when you arrive in to consult to or work with new businesses and new teams, where you focus with them and how you do align people to consider a different approach around some of those constructs?
Yeah, I think I think it starts with your own personal values and establishing, I think, that element of trust and known leadership. And so, you know, I often start with you know, what are the values that are strongest to me, or I like to see reflected in our business. And you know, that's about, you know, not blaming people and asking questions. It's about, you know, surrounding yourself with people who are radiators and not drains. You know, it's about doing the right thing, you know, in every situation. And it's about treating the business as your own, not walking past things that financially or emotionally, commercially don't make any sense. And I think that happens a lot. I think organizations can start to get excited through phases of growth, and they start to lose a little bit of focus on who their customer is. And when you lose focus on your customer, you start developing products that aren't suited to the business and to what has made that company or business successful. So the product starts to change. The ranging of your product might change. You might start to create a wider range of products, which costs you a lot more money. And then your core business shifts to different audiences, to different manufacturing processes, to different demands on your cash. And you can end up in a mess pretty quickly. That's not to say any or all of the businesses that I've come into have been a mess, but they've certainly had components of drifting away from understanding who their core customer is, what their core product is, and what their core business is. And I don't think it's super complicated what I do, really. I'm a relatively simple country boy, and you know, if I can see there's a customer there that's a value and is buying our product, then I reckon we double down on that. And if the price is too expensive or too cheap, I think we've got to get that right to make sure it meets the customer demand. And if the product is changing or is dropping in quality or isn't meeting the requirements of that customer, then that's a problem. Or if we're starting to get into areas of the business that we've never been in before, that we don't have intellectual property or capability around, then that's bad business. So I think for me, it's often a back to basics approach, and then to grow back out the business from there based on the strengths of the brand and the business and the customer.
Jim, what excites you most about the future for RB Sellers as a brand?
Well, I think we've got here in whatever it is, 27 years from 1996 to today. I think my maths are right there, Jeremy. I think you know, we've grown sustainably, but I think, you know, we've got more focused on our product. We divested both the Rossi and Dreiserbone brands in December last year, and brought focus back to RB Sellers, which is really, you know, 95% of what we sell. And you know, I think that's important in terms of being a customer orientated organization that has one brand that delivers on our promise every single day in every transaction. So I think getting that right, and then growing the accessibility of our product. I mean, I think, as I said before, I think we've got 22 stores across Australia and New Zealand. We'd love to have more stores, and we'd love to be in more high streets, in country towns and regional centres, because, you know, I think that's the tangibility of our product, access to it in towns. I'd like to grow our online business. I think it's a pretty good business at the moment, but could be a lot better business. So I think there's a lot we can do from a digital perspective, and I think we can grow with our customers towards the next generation as well. So, you know, we've got an event up in Rocky. I think we're all aware of Beef Week coming up, and we'll be sponsoring. We sponsor that every 3 years, but we'll be sponsoring Hats and Heels, and we're running a campaign with Howdy, which is a dating app for young farmers looking for love in the country. You know, this is all about us, you know, making sure that our brand fits our customer profile for today, but also what our customer looks like tomorrow. And we all know that there's a lot of transition happening in Australia at the moment in terms of, you know, property transferring from one generation to the next. So we're super keen to make sure we're multi-generational in our approach.
It's really encouraging when so many companies are moving away from country towns and main streets of smaller regional towns that you're actively wanting to increase your presence. And for mine, I think I can speak for Jane and our family, I don't think RB Sellers has ever missed Jim. It just is such a dependable brand, backed by great service, and it is such a dependable and stable product, isn't it?
Yeah, I love how you say we've never missed. I'm sure we've missed. Everyone misses, and I suppose we've missed sometimes, but mitigated. And I think, you know, if we stop taking risks and if we stop, you know, stop opening stores. I mean, we made some mistakes, you know, in towns that we've got wrong, you know, or our customer fit isn't right. We've made some investments in products that weren't quite right. But you do it because you're consistently testing, you know, testing the boundaries of our own capabilities and testing the boundaries of our customers. And I think that's an important part of what our business is today. And it motivates people, you know, it motivates people who are working there to know, yeah, we can take a risk and it's okay. And we stuff it up, and the customer mightn't see too much of it. But we certainly know about it. It costs us money, and it costs us time and energy and whatever else. But it is a you know, philosophy of growth. And I think we missed the beat a few times. But I think, you know, we're getting certainly back on track, and we're going to continue to be focused on growth.
Jim, we talked at the start about entrepreneurship. Red-handed Creative, I think, was one of the first companies that you launched and led. And I think over 12 years grew that business significantly. Would you mind just speaking to the early days of Red Handed and where it arrived to in its journey?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the business that I'm most proud of, you know, I think because I started it. And I think, you know, I started it with a partner as well, so a creative partner, and that was a great partnership, you know, and having that success together through that 12 years was fantastic. No, you string a glass of champagne or having a beer by yourself, so when things go right. So, I mean, the story of Red Handed started because I was a writer, I was a creative, and I wanted to communicate with rural Australians in a way that was respectful and really was a positive voice for rural and regional Australia. And I think through that period there was a lot of brands, and this is going back, you know, we're talking 2000 to 2012 or so, Jerome, you know, back then there was a lot of terrible advertising on rural television. I mean, you'd be familiar with it back then. It was incredibly patronising. Every farmer was a hayseed, and they were not really running businesses or given credit for running businesses. And, you know, we were really all about how do we present our customer, your customer, our client's customer, in a very positive light, that these people are real business people. These people are entrepreneurs. There's a lot of innovation every day. You know, they're engineers, they're vets, they're you know, mechanics. They have all of these extraordinary capabilities, and we need to honour that and how we communicate with them. So, you know, what hopefully we bought through that business was respect for the audience, that we produced communication that recognised the attitudes, values and behaviours of that audience and how they were different and how we'd connect with them. So, you know, whether it's chemical companies or fertiliser companies or biotech companies or, you know, government services, we wanted to reflect that in all the work we did. So thankfully it went well, and there was plenty of setbacks. You know, there was plenty of problems, clients that didn't pay us, and, you know, bad ads that, you know, we shouldn't have written, and, you know, there was all those sort of things and partnership pain and all those joyous experiences. But in the end, you know, we produced a business that we always intended on selling. So that was always, you know, that sort of light at the end of the tunnel, that when would there be that time and when would the business be ready to do that? And we planned for it, and it happened in 2012 and really set us up for, you know, the next part of our lives. For Paul, who was my creative partner at the time, he retired, so it was the right time for him to do that. For me, it allowed me to step into the company that acquired us, Clemenger BBDO, which I worked there for, you know, 10 years following that in senior executive roles, and ended up running the company. So it was fun.
So, Jim, Red Handed, would you mind just giving our listeners just a bit more insight as to what was the business, what was the problem you solved, who were some of your clients, and how did you help them?
So I think going back to what I said earlier about if you make something, you got to sell it, I think it was all about selling it. That's fundamentally what we were doing for every customer. So sometimes that's not just selling a product. We're not just selling, you know, Granuloc fertilizers or, you know, Roundup, which, you know, we work both those brands, but sometimes you're selling behavioral change. Sometimes you're trying to get people to adopt genetically modified cotton, move from conventional systems to, you know, something incredibly different. And so this process of changing behavior was a really interesting one, and a lot of modeling that we did was about, you know, what steps do you take and how do you communicate and allow that customer to change, and therefore then pay for your product, whether it's an expensive product or whether it's a tradable commodity. for the best effect. So in simple terms, we were selling it, Jerem. So that's what we were there to do, and everyone had something slightly different to sell. Might be safety, might be behavioural change, it might be fertilisers, chemicals or tractors. In the end, you know, we had a number of government clients, we had large banks, we had multiple tractor companies or machinery companies, you know, where we'd managed to grow the business so we could manage conflict across different brands, which was an interesting process and one that took us a long time to work out how to do. And we built a business, I think, that someone else wanted to buy, someone saw value in and still some potential in. And Red Handed continues today as part of the Clemenger BBDO stable of brands, and is still doing really well under the stewardship of one of my staff, still there and running it and doing a bloody great job. So it gives me immense proud to still see that business doing well.
Real credit to you, Jim. What was it like transitioning from being your own business owner to being part of a bigger company in Clemenger that then acquired Red Handed?
Oh, God. That's such a good question, because being an entrepreneur most of my life, there's things you get very used to. You know, there's that, you know, waking up in the morning with that sick feeling in your guts that the only way we're going to get through the day is if I get into the office first and open the doors and make the first client call and follow up the, you know, the first money that's owed to me or whatever it is. Or, you know, it's just like farming, getting up and doing those things every single day and making sure you're the one to start it is incredibly hard, but it's incredibly fulfilling. You know, you really feel like you're kicking the motorbike over every day for that business. And then, you know, when you enter a bigger business, you get into work and there's, you know, some 22-year-old whippersnapper in there who's been in there since about 4 a.m. and is pumping out spreadsheets and, you know, data, so you're ready to go when you get in there and you've got an EA dropping your coffee and, you know, you've got, you know, a board meeting coming up and you're preparing papers and you're masterfully managing people and situations that often feel quite removed from the business, you know, the core business. And it's a corporate sort of environment that I struggled with a little bit at the start because it was intangible. Couldn't touch it and feel it and see the customer every day and interact with it. So that was a tough sort of initiation, but I got used to it and put my own slant on how I managed our teams and managed situations, and also still got very, you know, involved and buried in projects. I think that's still important today. And you know, a couple of weeks ago at RB Sellers here, I went out to our DC and I picked and packed in our warehouse for the day just because I want to know what it was like, you know, and I met our team and, you know, the people that do that every day for our e-commerce orders. And I just think those things are really important in understanding a business, and the corporate world needs more of that. You know, at times you got to step out of managing people and managing situations and get your hands dirty. And I think that's where the rubber hits the road. So that's the ag in me, I think, Jerem.
Jim, a lot of our farmers are making that transition from having, as you described, being business owners in their right and on the tools to building out teams and being a little bit one step removed from being on the tools. And we talk about being the technician, the manager, and the leader. What advice have you got for people who are having to let go of some of the on the tools tasks and make that transition into management and then leadership and letting go of some of the tasks that perhaps they have always done and been comfortable with?
Yeah, I think there's some capability and there's mindset. And we tend to get drawn to the things that we like and the things that we're good at. And so we therefore avoid the things that we struggle with and the things that we're not quite sure we're good at. And so you get drawn back into the business often, I think, you know, certainly in my situation. But I think you know, educating yourself is a really good first step. Changing your mindset to not being drawn to the things you always done and the things you always like, but to the things that challenge you, to the things that make you a little bit uncomfortable, and then practicing them and testing and trialing and learning and knowing within yourself that it's not going to be right every time, but you're going to continue to test and trial and grow. And I think that is absolutely critical when you're making that transition from what you know to what you don't know. And being open, obviously, to good advice is another one. And I've always had very good mentors and coaches, if you like, in my life. I've never paid them, but I've had them and I've sought them out. And you know, I hate making mistakes, you know, repeatedly. I know that's the, you know, it's like a dog returning to its vomit, Jerem. You know, I don't want to go back there. And I think the opportunity is that you find people who've made those mistakes before and can teach and are prepared to share. And that really is a quicker path to growth in my mind.
Jim, you supported through Red Handed and Ben Clemenger some of Australia's most prominent agri brands and some of the most stable and significant products that the industry uses. How do you reflect that you've seen the farming community develop and advance over your 25-year-plus journey with the industry?
I think sustainability is the thing that is the word of the moment, right? But it's been hijacked, sustainability, around environmental sustainability. And I think true sustainability is the fact that it can live on, continue and prosper. And I think we've seen agriculture in terms of, you know, I was on the board of Career Harvest, which was, you know, an organisation with the Australian Council of Deans looking at how we can attract more kids to study agriculture at Australian universities. And at that time, for every ag graduate that left university, there was 12 jobs. And so there was huge scope to work all over the world or with some of the best organisations in the world, if only they studied ag, but we couldn't find any kids to study ag, right? So it was a, you know, from a legacy perspective, to see now that there's an enormous upswing in the amount of kids studying ag and recognising that ag and agribusiness, agriculture and agribusiness, are sustainable careers, to me is just brilliant. It's what it's all about. The fact that you can confidently say to your kids, if you're a farmer and a lifetime generational farmer, if you can say to your kids, it's okay to come home to the farm. I've got something here. We've got something. We've built something over generations here or in one generation, whatever it is that you can come back to and it's going to be viable and it's a legacy I'm leaving you to be successful, knowing you're going to be successful. Is ultimately what I've seen in my lifetime in agriculture. My dad said to me, don't dare come home. The farm's not big enough. You know, we don't, there's not enough money in this. You know, your world's bigger than this. I've sent you away to school. You know, these are bigger opportunities. And that helped me a great deal. I couldn't have gone home. I'm so glad he said that to me. But, you know, farmers today can say that to their kids, that if that's your choice and you want to come home, then, you know, there's a place for you here and it's going to be a great life and it's going to be a sustainable career. And ultimately, that's the most exciting thing for me.
It's wonderful, isn't it, that there is just so much optimism in our industry at the moment. And to your point, if it's on farm or in and around agribusiness, you know, and the significant supply chains that support the industry, yeah, it is. It's great to see that next generation showing real interest in a career in farming.
And it's not only agriculture either and farming, you know, like if you're a grain trader in, you know, with Cargill, you know, in a market, you know, in the Arab states or in Europe or in America, I mean, what an exciting and interesting career that is too. And imagine bringing those skills home to the farm after 20 years or 10 years or, you know, there's opportunities everywhere in secondary and tertiary industries. So it's not just about farming.
What do you reflect on in your career, Jim, that you're most proud of?
Well, hopefully I'm not reflecting too early, Jeremy. Hopefully there's still some good stuff left. but I think, I just think the fact that we bought back the family farm, you know, like 12 years ago, I often look for my own center of gravity, you know, when things are tough, and what is it that I love, you know, what is it that I feel connected to? And, we bought my grandfather's farm, mum and dad, you know, still next door, but a grandfather's farm in, not long after the sale of Clemenger. To Clemenger, and to me that was just a moment of immense pride, and to have our kids growing up in a country town and, you know, riding the motorbike down to the school bus or helping out with shearing or, you know, playing country footy or tennis or, you know, connecting with the upbringing that I had, was probably the moment. Now that's, you know, my daughter who's a footballer, Jeremy, would say, "Dad, you're so outcome orientated." You know, it's not about the outcome, it's the process. You know, these are the great lessons you get from your kids. But that was the outcome, you know, that is just, you know, really made me proud. You know, I've done a lot of work and I've done a lot of stimulating and interesting projects, but, that's certainly, from my perspective, what I'm most proud of at the moment, you know, and it's given me a foundation now to have a center of gravity, you know, in my life. So I can go out and I can do my board roles and my executive roles. And then a Friday arvo, I can drive up the driveway and, come home and look at my sheep and go around the stock. And, you know, that's probably the greatest thing about my career so far.
You mentioned, Jim, that you've had mentors and coaches. Would you mind speaking to one of them and perhaps some of the best advice or the best support that they've provided you on your journey?
It's funny, I've had a few, and I've got one particularly who is a fella called Rod Bennett, who started advertising agencies, very successful at them. Kiwi, don't hold that against him. Just a man with a lot of wisdom and, has been through a lot of experiences, you know, so could often share that with me when times were tough or indeed when times are good. And I used to get quite upset about, this is one example, there's so many different things, Jerome, but one thing I used to get quite upset about is when we'd do something as a business and someone would copy us. And, you know, I'd get really annoyed, you know, it's just like, you know, and he's like, don't worry about it. You know, you're leading, right? But they're stealing our customers, you know. They're doing what we did and doing it cheaper. And without our innovation, we took 10 years to come up with that or 5 years to come up with it. And Rod always used to just say to me, you know, trust your instincts, trust your ability, right? So, great. That's flattery. You're the original. That's all good. But you know what? What got you here is continuing to innovate, continuing to do the next thing, and having confidence in doing the next thing. So don't worry about that. Don't look back. You know, don't look sideways. Just go and develop the next thing, the next business or the next idea or the next product. And I think that's stood with me. You know, it's been really something that's given me a lot of confidence to say, actually, it doesn't matter what happens. The market shifts, a competitor jumps in, a product falls over or whatever else, what's the next thing? You know, and having confidence in the shower one morning, we're going to come up with another idea that's going to move us to that other place. And trusting your instincts and yourself and your ability is a really important part of that growth journey, I think, for everyone.
Thanks, Jim. There's another concept I'd love to explore with you. We see the need for farmers to make that transition from, for want of a better term, amateur to professional. And build out teams so that when they do take on expansion steps that they're building out structures, systems, teams that can support that sort of growth. We see lots of those clients running around with RB sellers shirts on now with brands about their farms. Given your brand experience, what advice have you got for farmers for how they can actually build out the professionalism of the businesses that run the farms and create teams and culture that are loyal to their farm brand?
Wow. A lot in that question, yeah. Jeremy. I think working on your own personal leadership is a really good start. So if you're clear about your plan and your vision, and you have the ability and the capability to express that really clearly, then people will follow you. So
can you just say that again, Jim? I'm really keen that people hear that.
Yeah, well, I think if you can develop the ability to clearly articulate your idea, then I think that's the most powerful thing that you can do. So that filters all the way through. Obviously, you need to plan for it. You know, these things don't come to you. You don't have clarity one day and not clarity the next. You need to understand your market opportunity and your product and what you're good at and how you're differentiated and distinctive and all of those factors. And how you're going to get the right product in the right time to the right customer at the right price. You know, all those factors are important. But as a leader, if you haven't gone through that process and you aren't clear about what it is, the purpose and the vision of why you're doing it and where you want to go, then it's very hard for others to follow. So that's the long version, Jeremy, you know, from the first commentary. But I think when others, you can convince other people underneath you that they believe in the same thing, or that thing is important to them, and that they can see the opportunity both individually and as a company, then, you know, I think it's incredibly motivating.
Linked to that, Jim, if I could, if I've got a vision which is to expand my farm for my children or for future generations, and the visions and goals can be about scale and size and ton or, you know, kilo of wool produced, how do I enroll my employed team in a vision that might be about constructs like that? Do you have any tips on how to enroll and inspire team to follow you toward a vision that might be about things like scale for family?
Yeah, I think patience is a virtue here, Jeremy, because I think a lot of people think that this happens overnight, you know, that businesses suddenly scale overnight, and they don't. You know, fundamentally, my belief is that business success is all about building momentum, and you need to have the long-term objectives and the short-term objectives. And sometimes, you know, when you can prioritize some of the short-term objectives or the priorities, and you start and finish them and win in the short, you get momentum quickly. And then the momentum can start to build into some of the longer-term objectives. And I really see this a lot in business. Businesses trip over because they're looking to a 5, 10, 15, 20-year horizon. And, you know, that's the destination, and we all want to get there. But there's going to be a whole heap of different journeys that are going to get us there. And the greatest level, you know, greatest thing around generating momentum from my perspective is about job satisfaction. And job satisfaction happens when you start and finish something. If you are continually working towards something and you never finish it, and you don't set micro goals and, you know, and have these ambitions that generate a level of satisfaction and therefore business momentum, it's very hard to get to the destination. So I think, you know, from my perspective, I think you've got to have the long and the short. And don't worry that the projects look small and short. Just make sure you really celebrate them when they're achieved, you know, because that level of satisfaction for the people that are working for you and with you, it's incredibly gratifying. and it generates momentum, it generates a growth mindset, and then the next project they can't wait to get into and get the same result. And then the next project, and then the next project. And before you know it, you've hit horizon one, two, three. You know, and I think it can be incredibly distracting and diminishing at times, going, I'm not getting there. You know, the farm's not big enough, right? And this has a compounding effect, doesn't it? You know, like you mightn't get to that size until the last 2 years when you're ready for transition. But those first 8 years or 10 years or 15 years or 20 years feel like you're never going to get there. And I think that's that resilience is, you know, really needs to be built up, and you can only be resilient when you have some success, when you achieve some goals. So, yeah, my advice there, and I'm no farmer, Jeremy. I'm a Collins Street farmer, mate. So I'm doing it well, and I'm not doing the farming well. It costs me money. Thank God I got a job off farm so I can fund the farming. But for those real farmers out there, I don't think the mentality should be any different. Make sure you win, have the short wins, and make sure you plan for the long.
And to your point, Jim, make sure that you celebrate the short-term wins with the team, so that they're motivated to help you with the next, and that builds momentum.
Yeah, for sure, and your family most of all, because they're the ones that, you know, they've got to be the toughest out of any of us, you know, to keep you upright.
Jim, I really appreciate your time. We had a few technical glitches in the lead up to this conversation, but thanks for sticking with those, and thanks for your insights. I always find that as farmers, we can learn so much looking at success outside of farming, and just to sort of hear and snippets of your new role with RB Sellers, but also to reflect with you on, I guess, the success you've had with Red Handed and Clemenger, and to hear how you have navigated those chapters and your leadership roles within those has just been so valuable. So, mate, as always, great to see you, and thank you so much for your time.
And thank you, Jeremy, and congratulations to you too. What you're doing is making a difference. So I know it'd be uncomfortable for you to hear that back, but you should be celebrating the successes too, because you've built an amazing business and you have some, you know, wonderful customers. So congratulations. And I'm watching every day to see how you continue to grow. And I'm, you know, I really love what I see. So congratulations.
Thanks, Jim. I really appreciate that. And like you, it's just the privilege to be part of a good project and a compelling team.
Good on you, Jerem.
Thanks, Jim. Take care and speak soon.
Good day. Cheers, mate.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Profitable Farmer Podcast by Farm Owners Academy. If you're new to this show, be sure to follow us. If you've been a long-time listener, let your friends know about us, or come continue the conversation in the Profitable Farmer Facebook group. All the best as you grow your business and create your freedom farm. Until next time, keep being incredible.